Hey, man, how's it going, y'all?
Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I do libertarian foreign policy mostly. Is this the one? Yeah. Today on the show, Seymour Hersh. Already recorded it this morning. And no, the rest of you guests, I will not record the show at another time for you. But for Hersh, okay, yeah. Everybody else, you either do the show live or you don't get interviewed. Those are the rules, because I don't have time in my life to sit around doing a bunch of radio at times other than when I'm on the radio. I think you could understand. Hey, chat room guys, can you hear the birds outside? There's birds. Oh, well, he shut up, of course, as soon as I gave him a minute. There's loud birds. They're making loud noises. All right. Anyway, I recorded one with Seymour Hersh this morning. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com, the scene of the crime. About Hersh going back to My Lai. And what do you learn? And this and that. Also, Kelly Vlahos will be here to talk about the second war that David Petraeus lost. Oh, he's the greatest general since George Washington. Well, he's about as good a general as George Washington, if that's what you mean. You ever read Rothbard on Washington? What a lousy human and especially lousy general he was. Well, maybe lousy general and especially lousy human being he was. Oh, really lousy. Really lousy. But anyway, yeah, David Petraeus, everybody's mad at him for cheating on his wife and then for leaking secrets to his mistress. Nobody seems to mind that he extended and then lost two wars. Oh, you gotta respect the office. No, I don't. I don't have to respect David Petraeus at all. In fact, I think he's the biggest joke of a human being on the face of this planet. The only thing I could compliment him on is his ability to manipulate idiots in the media. Wow, you sure have a lot of shiny costume jewelry on your shirt. You must be really good at winning wars, they say, as though they don't know that America lost two wars under David Petraeus' leadership. Extended, and then lost anyway. But yeah, so Kelly B. Vlahos from the American Conservative Magazine, she'll be on the show to talk about what a pathetic joke of a loser, of a failed human being, disgrace, piece of garbage David Petraeus is, and a state that he's left Afghanistan in. Guess what? It's as bad as before, maybe worse. It's pretty good for the Undertaker industry over there, you know. The heroin industry. The NGO and the U.S. military industries. But, yeah, no, the Afghans, they all lose. The regular people over there, they lose. And Kelly's on all about all the new warlords that David Petraeus put in power in Afghanistan. Boy, and then he hightailed it out of there. Who, me? I'm just the head of the CIA writing up reports about what a great job I did in Afghanistan back when I was a general. Anyway, I like making fun of Petraeus because everybody loves him so much. Because he is, he's pretty damn good at PR. I guess you can't deny it. That's all he's good at is PR, but yeah. That's all. All right, so, yeah. Hey, I owe you guys an update on the Kickstarter. Well, it's housekeeping time. ScottHorton.org, that's where I keep all my stuff. Go there. Twitter.com/ScottHortonShow, that's where I keep my tweets. Follow me on Twitter and retweet me. It's mostly just me complaining about how much I hate cops and other government employees. You'll love it. It's great. Arguing about Rand Paul. That's twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. If you want to follow me on there. And, yeah, what else do I need to tell you about housekeeping stuff? I guess that's it. Just retweet me, god dang it. All right, good. Now the Kickstarter. I owe you guys an update on the Kickstarter. I already told you it's over. And I already told you thank you, but thank you again. Thank you, everyone. But now here's the thing. Apparently, those of you who have pledged, you may not have gotten the money deducted from your account yet. I understand from Matt Perry, who helped me set this thing up, that sometimes it takes as long as 2 weeks after the goal date, the end date of the Kickstarter project, for the money to actually get transferred. So make sure you keep lots of money in your bank accounts. Because Kickstarter may not have deducted your pledge yet. I'm not exactly sure how that works. But I did email back and forth briefly with Matt Perry, and he is now talking with Carlos, the computer genius, who very soon will be getting to work on this project. I got to talk with Matt this afternoon about all this and that. But anyway, I want to let you guys know that I'm not just taking the money and spending it on crack or anything like that. The money is going to Carlos. He's doing the YouTube project, but it takes a little while to get started, apparently. The project was successfully funded 7 days ago, as it says here at Kickstarter.com. But it still may be another week or more, maybe, I don't know, before they actually take the money from you, those of you who pledged. So just to let you know, this is still a thing. Oh, yeah, it's a thing. And it's going to be a pretty good thing, I think. That's my plan, is for it to be a good thing. Because, you know, well, a lot of people never heard of the show before. And some of them might like it if they heard it. And putting 3,500 plus, really 3,600 interviews on YouTube seems like possibly a good way for people to find out about the show. Start listening to it. That's the goal. And maybe I'll get a little bit of YouTube ad money too. I don't know. All right, good. So that's the Kickstarter update. I am still extremely grateful. And I want you to know that, yes, it's still a thing and it ain't happened yet, but it's gonna happen. We're working on it now. We're right in the middle of the middle. We're in the middle of the beginning. Hey, look at that. Categorized by interviews here, it says I have 3,744 interviews. Now more than 3,700 of them going back to 2003. How do you like that? Boy, I sure do interview people a lot, don't I? I guess so. And for a long time, too. Okay, cool. And then one more thing before we got to this first break here real quick. I wanted to mention religion. I usually don't talk about religion very much on the show at all, except it keeps coming up, especially in the context of Israel, because the Israeli government, and especially the Likud party, they claim this mystical, magical property right to Palestine based on ancient Hebrew mythology, even though the vast majority of the population of Israel are a bunch of white Europeans. Who, well, just to show you how ridiculous it is, my grandma's mom was Jewish. And so even though I'm a white boy from Texas, I have supposedly a divine right to settle the occupied West Bank, and the Palestinians who've been from there for 3,000 years straight don't have that right at all. But that doesn't mean that I'm anti your religion or I'm an avowed, you know, Bill Maher type atheist where I just hate it. I'm a Jeffersonian on the matter. I don't care if you have one god or ten, it neither picks my pocket or breaks my leg, so no disrespect. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Dang, hard breaks always interrupting me, man. I was just trying to say, I ain't religious, but I haven't been anti-religious since about 10th grade, because who cares? All I believe in is liberty, and that means first and foremost, I believe in your sovereignty over your own mind. Even if you went off to a government war and you got all your, limbs and torso blown off and you're nothing but a brain in a jar, still, you own you. You can believe whatever you want. I ain't against that. I just resent it when people, you know, use their religious beliefs to justify violating other people's rights. Like the entire state of Israel on a daily basis, for example. Like the entire state of the United States of America on a daily basis, for example. But I don't mean to pick on you for being a Protestant or a Catholic or a Sunni or a Shia or a Buddhist or a Shintoist or a whatever the hell you want to believe in. Whatever flavor of Hinduism or whatever. Neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. That's what Thomas Jefferson said, and I agree with him 100%. Just don't pick my pocket or break my leg. At that point, I'll start to get pissed off. But, I resent the militant anti-religionists like, Bill Maher and all those creeps that he hangs out with as much as the religionists, the ones who use it as their excuse, really. Because the enemy is power, okay? Not weak people. Powerless people who believe things you disagree with. Give me a break. And by the way, all this crap about Islam is the enemy. Did you ever notice that America never had a problem with Muslims until America had a world empire that dominated Muslim majority parts of the world? Why, it's almost as if they've been lying to you about Islam being the root cause of terrorism. When in fact, terrorism is motivated by human, earthly, political reasons. Like, for example, mass murder by American military forces in other people's countries. And like, for example, unlimited blank welfare checks to the state of Israel to and along with military transfers of weapons from M16s to F-16s. To the Israelis, for use against civilians, for use in war crimes against helpless people in Palestine and in Lebanon. That's the reason we have a terror war problem. Was it radical Islam that motivated the kamikaze pilots of Japan in World War II? Were they radical Shintoists? Were they so brainwashed into worshiping the emperor that they would do kamikaze attacks? No, they were fighting to protect their homeland from invasion. Don't be stupid, you stupid. Well, I don't know, Scott. TV told me to hate and fear Muslims. Yeah, well, so that's what the Israelis want. So good for you for being a tool of a foreign power. Why don't you try scratching your head for a second and think real hard? Hey, you're right. Ike Eisenhower overthrew the government of Iran. And then when the people of Iran overthrew it back in 1979, Jimmy Carter hired Saddam Hussein to kill 500,000 of them. And then when Saddam Hussein got too big for his britches and invaded Kuwait after James Baker told him, go ahead, what the hell do I care? Then America killed, 50,000, 75,000 in the war, and then another million people during a decade-long blockade after the war from bases in Saudi Arabia
the Holy Peninsula, land of Mecca and Medina. It just means, I mean, hell, how would you like it if the Saudis put a military base in your county, which ain't holy land? Just matters a lot to you because it's where you're from. But make it holy land, they resent it that much more. But again, it ain't Islam that mandates the war. And anyway, I don't know. Are people really dumb enough to still believe that Islam is the problem here? Can't you tell that they're lying to you? Jeez, I don't know, Scott. You know, when you asked me to scratch my head there, I went ahead and I tried it, and then it occurred to me that there are a billion Muslims in the world and that we have a problem with a few thousand of them. Huh. It's almost as though Islam isn't the problem. And, you know, then I scratched the other side of my head and it occurred to me there are approximately 5 million Muslims in America. And if Islam made them want to hate and kill Americans, then all of our cities would be on fire right now. We would have a full-scale war inside our country right now. But that's not happening because it's not true. My God, the things you can come up with if you just think about the things you already know for a second. And turn off your damn television. Oh, I guess that's just me. Okay, coming up in just a second, Seymour Hersh. I love Seymour Hersh, man. I wrote out all these notes I wanted to ask him, and I thought, come on. Seymour Hersh loves talking, man. I asked him one question. He talked for 17 minutes. the whole interview is, let me see here, I got it. The whole interview is 33 minutes long, so what that means is you live audience types are going to miss some of the interview. Actually, that's not true, because I only have two guests today, so I guess I can break it up into three segments. So that's what I'll do for you. When we get back from the break, we'll start the Seymour Hersh interview, and then we'll have that for three segments. And I'll have one more segment to talk about probably Israel and Palestine or the Iran program, or maybe America flying as Iran's Air Force in Iraq again right now, or I'm not sure what. And then we'll have Kelly Vlahos on about Afghanistan, so that's coming up here in just a few. But in fact, let me talk about that right now. U.S. begins flights over to Crete as 105 are killed in Iraq. That's Margaret Griffiths at original.antiwar.com/updates. And, you know, they started this thing. It was the Quds Force and the Shiite militias and what's left of the Iraqi army, about 10,000 troops or 5,000 troops in the Iraqi army, 30,000 Shiite militiamen, and the Iranian Quds Force leading the thing. But then they decided they needed American air power, and so here we go. America acting as Iran's air force. And you know me, right? There ain't nobody more in favor of a nuclear deal with Iran than me. There ain't nobody more in favor of telling the truth about the completely harmless civilian nature of Iran's nuclear program than me. There ain't nobody happier to debunk lies about Iran more than me. But that doesn't make me an apologist for Iran, and it sure as hell doesn't make me an apologist for Iran's policy in Iraq, which has been an absolute genocidal catastrophe for the last 12 years, ever since they hired George Bush and they thought Israel first neocons to get rid of Saddam Hussein for them. With absolutely the complicity of Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and David Petraeus, they got a million people killed in the Iraqi civil war, and now they just continue to make matters worse and worse and worse, and it is absolute madness. It's a war crime. Barack Obama ought to be impeached and removed and convicted and sentenced to life in prison just for his actions today in flying air cover for the Quds Force into Crete. It's murder. It's evil. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Introducing the great Seymour Hersh from The New Yorker magazine, the man who broke the story of the My Lai Massacre back in 1969, and now he's got a brand new one in The New Yorker about it, called The Scene of the Crime, about his recent return there. Welcome back to the show, Cy. How are you?
Okay.
Good, good. Very happy to have you back on the show. Now, listen, we got a real young audience here, and this whole thing happened even before I was born, so can we start, please, with maybe just sort of a small review of exactly what was the My Lai Massacre?
Sure. Actually, it's My Lai, but that's the way they pronounce it there. And everybody pronounces it My Lai. But all that happened was that we were in the middle of a I'm a kid reporter in Washington, freelancer. I'd worked for the AP in Washington, covering the Pentagon for a couple of years in 66 to 67, and sort of learned OJT, on-the-job training, what a mess was going on in Vietnam. The promotions, basically, in some areas, the area in some areas where the fighting was very intense, promotions were based, you know, if you wanted to get from major to lieutenant colonel to colonel, or even, you know, lieutenant to captain, it was all based on body count, how many kills you had. And so you had an American army that was in Vietnam, fighting in a culture it did not understand, against people whose language and skills and way of life was foreign to them. Our boys weren't particularly well trained in the subtleties of the Vietnamese, and to put it mildly, and there was a lot. Over time, inevitably, particularly since for most units in the war, they rarely ran up against regular soldiers. The North Vietnamese weren't much of a. We were fighting a war. We were in fighting a war against what we thought was the international communism. It was the idea was that the North Vietnamese were communists and they wanted to take over the South. We were supporting a very corrupt government in the South. This is an old picture that happens to us an awful lot. If you're anti-communist, no matter how despotic you are, we're with you. And we got drawn more and more into the war. It was going not well, never winnable. But we were fighting a guerrilla war in a country we didn't understand, with allies who weren't very dependable. I mean, you know, this is a picture we've seen again and again in Afghanistan and Iraq, et cetera. And inevitably, the war, it sort of morphed from a war against, the enemy to a war against the people. And so the climax, and particularly in the area where the My Lai was a small hamlet, a sub-hamlet, actually, in Quang Nai province, which is in the northern part of South Vietnam. And Vietnam is now one country. The North won the war in 1975. But before then, it was divided in half. There was an international conference in 1954 in which a division was made, like between North and South Korea. And in the northern part of the South Vietnam, there was a lot of support for the against the government. Many of the we call the people we are the guerrillas we were fighting the Viet Cong for Vietnamese communists, but many of them were nationalists. They weren't interested in communism as much as they hated the South Vietnamese government. There was also a religious component. Many Vietnamese were Buddhist, and the controlling government was Catholic. And so there was a series of complicated issues, wrong day, wrong side, wrong day. Anyway, there was a very violent war, and particularly in three provinces, Quang Nai, Quang Tri, and Quang Nam, which were basically marked, in some areas they were marked on American maps with in pink for communists, for red. It's hard to believe now that we were so adamant and so ignorant, but we really thought that if we didn't stop communism, if the North Vietnamese communists took over the South, it would be the beginning of what we call the domino theory. All of Southeast Asia would fall to the communists, et cetera, Thailand, et cetera, Laos, Cambodia. And the only problem with that thinking, of course, is that Vietnam and China And also, it would mean that Chinese communism would also be very much more important. All that stuff factored into our decision to put 500,000 men into the war. We lost 58,000 in the war, and the Vietnamese in the war lost anywhere between 1 to 2 or more than 3 million. And so, in one day in 1968, a group of American kids in a not very distinguished army unit known as the AmeriCal Division, sort of a third-rate division. They'd been in Vietnam. They were draftees mostly, and they'd been trained in Hawaii. They went to Vietnam at the end of the beginning of 1968, maybe late 67. They spent 3 months, living in the boonies, not getting good food, not getting great showers. They were humping it. They were the expendables. They were the bottom of the pit for us. And the company lost about 20 men to snipers and bamboo pits, pits with the bamboo sticks with poison on them, all sorts of stuff. Never met the enemy, never had a set-piece fight, never saw, because they were fighting irregulars, they were fighting a war against, as we say, a guerrilla war. And we began to think that they were farmers by night and guerrillas at night, so the American soldiers began to start beating up farmers, this particular group, Charlie Company it was called. And they were very poorly disciplined, really out of control. They were part, in 1968, there was going to be a big attack. We had intelligence in March of 68, March 16th, that there was going to be a Viet Cong battalion, a real group of Viet Cong, lousy intelligence, it was always lousy intelligence, in this village called My Lai that was known to be pro-communist or pro-Viet Cong. And so this company, part of a task force, there were two companies that went on an attack, but Charlie Company, the one that did the atrocity, one of the companies that did it, Charlie Company was given a briefing that said, you're going to meet the enemy, take no prisoners, all the civilians will leave in the morning. It's just phantasmagorical stuff. I don't know where that intelligence briefing came. It was just lousy stuff. But the kids, to their credit, these kids who didn't know much about anything, some of them, most of them, were, high school kids, young, ignorant, had learned to hate the enemy because they never saw them. They were frightened of them, but they also wanted to kill them. They got up in the morning at 3:45, to their credit. They did their toking and they did their, shooting up and they did their drinking, as guys did, although nobody wants to admit to it. And they got on choppers to go kill and be killed. You got to give them that much due. They went there, but of course there was no enemy there. There were just, more than 500 women and children, some old men making breakfast. They got there around before 7. And for some reason, they just went nuts. They rounded up people in some cases. They executed more than 400 people. Some escaped. A lot of raping. They just killed everybody. It was a horrible mess, and it was known. As the killing went on, various officers, ranging to the major general, a guy named Coster, in charge of the division, were circling above watching. A deputy, the commanding general was a 2-star. His deputy, a guy named Young, was a 1-star. There was a colonel named Henderson who was in charge of, they're all in charge of units up the chain of command. It goes from a platoon to company, in this case to task force, and then to a brigade, and then to a 1-star general. And they all watched. I wrote 2 books about it, one about the incident itself called My Lai 4, and one about the cover-up. I wrote that was 2 years later I wrote it. I spent a lot of time on this. But I just heard about it. I was a kid reporter. They just killed everybody that day and went on the next day. That's the way it was, and continued the war. And everybody in the division, or most people knew, it was their day was 407 men, women, and children slaughtered. The task force had another company called Bravo, which attacked a village, sister village, about 1.5 miles, maybe 2 miles less than that, away, and executed 97 people there. So one task force of a couple of companies on one day killed 500 people. It got covered up. This is the March of 68. In March of 69, a guy named Ronald Ridenour, a wonderful kid who's not in the unit.
All right. That's my interview with Seymour Hersh from this morning. When we get back, all about Ridenour and the rest of the story, right after this.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
But he was a soldier, a reconnaissance soldier, having to fly over that area the next day over My Lai and saw the smoke, I guess the leftover bodies, and knew what a mess it was. Some of the bodies were buried then. And he waited till he got out. Everybody was afraid to do anything. You don't report war crimes. There's no such thing as a war crime then, just mistakes. And Ridenour wrote a letter that began an inquiry. Nothing much happened. The army was very slow going. And finally, that fall, 69, 18 months later, I'm a freelance reporter. Then I covered the Pentagon, but then I worked in 1968 as a press secretary and speechwriter for a guy named Gene McCarthy, who ran as an anti-war candidate against the sitting president for the presidential nomination. He ran against Johnson and did well, almost defeated Johnson in New Hampshire, and Johnson quit because he knew the anti-war stuff was really bad. And I did that, and I went off to be a freelancer and was writing and, you know, making a living, I guess. Not much, but okay. And in late 69, somebody called me with a tip about this, and I just sort of believed it. I've been following the war. I knew that how bad things were. And from my years of covering the Pentagon for the AP, I also knew from soldiers, some officers, that a lot of murder was going on. I just believed the story and eventually found my way to the infamous, famous Kelly, the sort of the leader of the killing. Every officer in the company, were five or six lieutenants, was killing, but Kelly was the most outspoken and the most aggressive, had men gather people into ditches and then order them to kill. And so I spent a lot of time, had a lot of trouble getting to Kelly. I finally found who the Army, although they were prosecuting him and they were investigating it by this time because of the letter by Ridenour, it was all done very slowly. I think the Army's goal was to convince Kelly, who was the fall guy, to plead guilty to manslaughter. But he wasn't doing it. I had a lawyer, and eventually I got into it, and I found Kelly. I found his lawyer, wrote a story that nobody wanted. What else is new? There was a little anti-war news agency called Dispatch News Service that was running stuff out of Vietnam and Southeast Asia that I'd written for as a freelancer. I used to write for the Washington Post Outlook section, their Sunday section, but I was making, but I could sell. I also wrote for the Dispatch. I would syndicate pieces and, you know, make some money. That's what I was doing. And I got into the story, got to Kelly. Nobody wanted it, as I said, and I took it to the Dispatch, and they put out, in 5 weeks, I wrote five stories about it, each one worse than the other. And all the newspapers eventually, you know, started buying it. They began to write their own story, and it all was correct, and I, you know, fame, fortune, glory. I got all my prizes, all sorts of prizes. But I went on because I knew that just writing about the massacre wasn't enough. I knew that there had been a systematic cover-up. And I wrote a second book about it for the New Yorker in 1972 that was excerpted two long pieces. So it was a horrible event. The charge against Kelly was initially that I found a piece of paper that said he was accused of killing 109 Oriental human beings, which is a really strange thing to say, as if somehow 10 white human beings equaled one Oriental. As soon as I wrote it, in the first story I did about Kelly, the Army changed the charge to killing 109, or was 111 human, deleting the word Oriental. Very racist idea. But so was the war. And so it was shocking to America. We, you know, America, the America that I grew up with, I was in my early 30s and 60s, 1969, we didn't know much about what really went on in war. You know, World War II was censored. There was a wonderful book written by a Yale professor named Paul Fussell on the censorship, years earlier on the censorship of World War II. We didn't see pictures of American dead. We didn't see pictures of the burned and maimed Germans and Japanese we killed. We didn't see that. That wasn't allowed. We weren't allowed to see those pictures. So we really didn't have a good sense of war. And then, as luck would have it, when I began to write my stories about My Lai, an Army photographer named Haberly, who'd been assigned to cover that mission, it was supposed to be a big event that day, also did shoot some pictures for the Army in black and white, but had a private camera with color, and he took the pictures of the massacre. Unbelievable pictures that when I wrote my story, he gave them to the Cleveland Blaine dealer. And in the middle of my stories, all of a sudden, here came these pictures from Haberly about a ditch full of bodies and other atrocities. I mean, incredible murders. It depicted. And there's nothing like a picture. So that all added up to a great controversy in America. A lot of anger about whether the story should have been written, et cetera, et cetera. But the mainstream press, to its credit, got into the story. And so it was just great. It was, you know, professionally got me started, I guess, in a way, as a serious player. But also, for the country, it was very shocking. We always thought we fought wars a little better, a little differently than the Nips, the Japanese, and the Krauts, as we called them, in World War II. Of course, the Holocaust was the Holocaust. But in combat, it turns out that all war is horrible. All armies kill. All armies do brutal things. All armies hate the other people. We've seen examples of that in Afghanistan and in Iraq, the atrocities. And as you know, some of your audience know, I'm the guy that wrote about the Abu Ghraib prison, the way we treated prisoners there, the nakedness and the sexual abuse, and the horrible ways we tortured prisoners. It's all part of a horrible, grimy package. As awful as My Lai and traumatic as it was for America, as awful as Abu Ghraib was in 2004 for most Americans and shocking, My Lai was probably even worse because we really just didn't know how bad it was and how brutal we could be. We always thought American boys had a higher standard. So it's receded in memory now, although I will say this piece I did is being tweeted all over. There's a lot of bounce to it. There's a lot of sort of residual historical interest in it. As you know, it's called the Return to the Scene of the Crime.
Right. Now, well, there's a lot to go over there, but I guess, first of all, about the import of the story then, I mean, I guess I'm aware that a lot of the right kind of rallied around Cali and said it's no big deal, but I think you kind of make the point in the piece that this really was a big deal for the anti-war movement in the United States of America, that this was kind of a turning point, sort of like when they found out about the secret bombing of Cambodia, that kind of thing.
Well, you know, it's interesting because in this, I wrote this story in late 69, November and December, and by 70, the campuses were going crazy. If you remember, there was some of your young kids would even know that in May, there was a demonstration at Kent State University, and National Guardsmen actually shot four student demonstrators. They panicked out. And so it became a big thing in terms of the anti-war movement, this kind of atrocity, no question. You're right, there was a tremendous amount of visceral support, particularly in the South. Cali was a Southern boy, but in Florida, he was went to junior college in Florida. I think he was out of North Carolina. In any case, Lieutenant Kelly, who was the only one who spent time, 14 officers ranging up to a two-star general were accused of various problems, you know, dereliction of duty. But Kelly was tried. He was the only. He went through a court-martial, and in I think May of two May or early yeah May in the spring of 1971, a year and a half after the first stories, Kelly was found guilty of the murder of 21 innocent civilians by his peers, by an army jury composed of senior officers, not all seniors, but majors and lieutenant colonels, et cetera. And so all of the feelings that many people had that this was unfair, that Kelly was only doing his job, and this all this stuff about mass murder was an exaggeration, sort of disappeared. My story had some impact, but the actual conviction of Cali, after that, Richard Nixon, the war was over. basically. Richard Nixon had been able, the president who replaced Johnson, Nixon was able, had been able to rally what he called Middle America. He could say, I need your support. But after this, Middle America was gone. They supported him on the war, and it turned out we were mass murdering people. So I think cumulatively, yeah, what I wrote, but also the Army's prosecution of Kelly and conviction. Mm-hmm. That made it a dead man walking.
Right. All right, now I just wanted to read this very small portion.
All right, it's my interview of Seymour Hersh, author of the Spotlight article today on antiwar.com. Return to the scene of the crime of the My Lai massacre from 1968. And we'll be right back with the rest after this top of the hour break. ScottHorton.org. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Of the piece, so that people understand here, you say 504 victims from 247 families. 24 families were obliterated. 3 generations murdered with no survivors. Among the dead were 182 women, 17 of them pregnant. 173 children were executed, including 56 infants, and 60 older men died as well, were killed as well. A little bit of a taste of what that number really means when you say 407 killed. Yeah, those are 407 individual human beings, all right. Now, let me ask you about Cali and the actual massacre itself. He obviously, as you say, he was the only one prosecuted for it. But you mentioned there the generals were flying around in the helicopters above. And in the story, you say that at first they just had the at least one group of villagers kind of rounded up and held under watch in the middle of a village for a while. Cali walked away. He came back and said, OK, kill them all. And I wonder whether you think or do you know whether those orders came from anyone above him or not, or it was just he decided, let's go ahead and do this.
Well, let's put it this way. You know, that's an amazing moment because there was a young boy named Milo. What made the story, and Paul Milo was somebody I heard about when I began to do the story, because he was a farm kid from New Goshen, Indiana, got drafted. I talked to his brother the other week before the story ran, and his brother told me that his brother was afraid of blood. I mean, he was the last guy to go to war, but he was drafted, and he went in. And when they went into the village, they around there were 3 platoons. Cali was a platoon leader of platoon, let's say A, and put the B and C, the second and third platoons. They just went around on others on this not a big village, but they had each had a section. The other guys just went through house to house and just shot and raped and murdered. Cali rounded up people and put them by a big ditch and told Paul Milo to take care of them. So Milo and another young boy from Texas did what American kids do. They had a bunch of kids and women they were supposed to take care of. They gave the kids candy, and they horsed around with them, played little games with them, and told the woman and where to sit. And Cali came back, and he said to Milo, what are you doing? I told you to take care of them. He said, well, I am. He said, no, I mean waste them. And Milo was stunned, and I didn't know this when I first did my reporting. I only learned this when I went back to it. I went back to My Lai. I didn't want to go. I'd been to Vietnam as a journalist for the New York Times a couple of times during the war in Hanoi and in Saigon, but I never wanted to go back to My Lai. I just didn't want to. But my family had been, for 30 years, been pushing me hard, and finally I said, okay. You know, it's a great tourist place now, Vietnam, and so we went, and I spent a couple of days at the My Lai. It was very tough to do, but I went to the village, and it reminded me all of these things, and Cali told Milo, waste them, and Milo began to cry, but he did it. He shot bullets into them. And so, you know, and all of this, as you said, is being observed by officers, all of whom in real time covered it up. And the general whose name I mentioned, General Coster, by the time my stories got written, a year and a half later after this event, was going to be promoted to a 3-star lieutenant general, and was at the time, get this, commandant of West Point, the military, the Army's elite military academy, where all most of their future generals go through their college education and early military training. So it was a huge friggin' mess for the military, plus the fact that so many senior officers were obviously aware of it. The story was, even though many knew what was going on and many knew how bad it was in real time, one helicopter pilot saw what was going on and landed and actually had his gunners put their guns on Lieutenant Kelly. He was going to throw a grenade into a ditch full of people. And instead, he put his head, they're broadcasting this. It's on the airwaves. It's on the radios in the headquarters, and everybody else listening can hear this conversation. He tells Kelly if he makes a move to go another move, he's going to kill him. He's going to have his gunners open up on him, and he takes the Vietnamese hiding in a ditch and flies him out. It was in a small gunship. He made a couple trips to fly him out to safety, the civilians. All of this was reported. All of this was a mess. Mm-hmm. And yet, a day later, the official report on the front page of the New York Times, as relayed by the command in Saigon, was big victory in the village of My Lai. They called it Pinkville. 128 Vietnamese Viet Cong killed, 3 weapons captured, all in the front page. So it was just a mess.
Yeah, Hugh Thompson Jr., that helicopter pilot. And that's what really stopped the massacre at that point, right, was his intervention?
Well, it was sort of, they were done massacring. There weren't many left because, 100 people or so escaped and fled, but the others were just killed. It was hard to believe because Army units had gone through the village before and, not done this. But this, one of the things you have to know is that there was nothing of this scale before, but killing 60, 40, 80, 100, as happened in the sister village, was going on all the time.
Right.
Going on all the time.
That was one of the things I wanted to ask you about. There's this new book by Nick Turse, Kill Anything That Moves.
Sure.
And he talks about this.
Nick did the book a couple of years ago.
Right, right. And, yeah, not that new, but relatively new, where he's gone through and he got all the documents from the Army war crime investigations. That's where he found it. And he basically says My Lai is exceptional because it became such a big story because of Hirsch's reporting and because it was so many people killed just in one spot. But otherwise, people should understand that the Vietnam War was basically a My Lai massacre every day.
Well, Nick wrote about other horrific areas in the Mekong Delta and elsewhere, other areas where they were incredible. Here's the issue. The issue was, and this is something that Nick writes about too, is the issue was that in Vietnam there just was no such thing as a war crime, apparently. There was a violation of rules, but the idea that you would walk into a village and slaughter everybody, well, that wasn't a war crime. That was just a mistake, over aggression. And there was something that emerged from the war called the MGR, the Mare Gook Rule, which was a basic defense to, if you were caught killing somebody, the Vietnamese, well, they were merely a gook. Mare Gook Rule, it was called. It was an informal sort of explanation. And so if you're a company commander, let's say, and you're a captain, you want to make major, and this is the only life you're going to have, you're not on the outside, you're not going to be able to cut it. You didn't get through college, but here the Army's helped you out and made you a captain. And your guys have gone off and killed everybody. You had two options. You could begin a war crimes investigation and ruin your career and everybody in the chain of command. Or you could simply do the best you can, cover it up, and find some number to report that's high, like 128 Viet Cong, that'll help your career. And that's what happened. That was the choice that happened. I'm afraid to say the same kind of stuff. We're not talking about the same degree of killing. But on a day-to-day basis, there certainly hasn't been enough prosecutions of war crimes or suspected war crimes in Iraq, in the Afghan war. A lot of bad stuff happens. It happens in all wars. There's nothing special about Americans in that. And, we like to think there is, but there isn't. We have a lot of good guys who fight the war right. But this particular division, the AmeriCal division, was known throughout the Army as not being el primo, being sort of a dumping ground. And their small unit leadership was just horrible. It was just a disgrace. And, you know, I hate to say it, but, you know, you can shape one of the things about young boys in the military. You can shape them in such a way that if you're not at all interested in the rules and fighting, you know, fighting honorably and fighting correctly, you can shape it in such a way that a melee is almost inevitable.
Yeah.
And so that's what happened. We had really a collapse of leadership in the Army. And I think, to the Army's credit, by the end of the 1970s, the war ended in 75, our active participation ended in 73. But by 78, 79, they had some better leadership. And they really, some of the younger officers recognized that, you know, I used to go speak to, after I did the Milai stories and the books, I would go talk to renegade lieutenant colonels and colonels and majors who wanted to change the system and change the way it worked. And there were a group of dissidents in the Army who did get some change. They got better leadership, so it did get better. But
right back with the rest of this Seymour Hersh interview in just a sec. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions.
Inevitably, when you're in the kind of war we are, the same sort of, you know, it's not as if we have much of a learning curve. When you're in Iraq or you're in Afghanistan, you're fighting in a country with, and you don't know the language and you're not particularly coached in the culture. You don't really, you know, we have tremendous problems with our soldiers who, in the Arab world, you don't go into a house without being invited. You don't go into the woman's quarters without, you know, you just don't go. You're not invited. You're not there. And you certainly don't go through their personal effects. You don't go looking for whatever they look, guns, by tossing through clothes in the women's quarters. And we make, you know, we just do culturally despotic things that turn people bad enough. We bomb them bad enough. We have drones, but in the field, we do so many things that aren't conducive to gaining support, even from people who might otherwise be interested in seeing people like Saddam, Saddam Hussein get overthrown. We ended up just creating a great animus towards us.
Yeah. Now, can
I'm
you
gonna
tell...
I'm going to have to go in 2 minutes. Is that all right?
Okay, yeah, sure. Let me ask you, I guess, just one more question then, finally. Is it really right that Lyndon Johnson and Robert McNamara knew all along that the war was pointless and hopeless?
Well, certainly Johnson didn't want to know that. McNamara, I think, I do write about quite a bit about McNamara in the end. I see him as a tragic figure. He's somebody who thought loyalty to the president was the most important element of his career, his life, his job as Secretary of Defense, and not loyalty to the reality. He did tell the president in private things were going badly. And by 67, he actually was fired by Johnson. I think it's fair to say most likely. We're not 100% sure what exactly what happened, but I think he told Johnson at some point in 67 we had to stop the bombing, stop sending more boys there, it's useless. But he never said a word publicly. And so in the end, I write about him quite critically, even though he was tortured in the end. I don't think he never really opened up, you know, about what he knew and what he didn't tell us. Sort of a misguided sense of loyalty. It was sad. So he certainly knew. I don't think Johnson could believe. I think Johnson just thought he had to win the war. It says so much terrible about our leadership that we get into this notion that a president can only be a great president if he wins a war. Jack Kennedy, that was a thought Jack Kennedy had. Great presidents, he once told a Harvard historian, who were the great presidents? Roosevelt and Lincoln. What do they have? They had wars. This is true. He told that to Herbert Donald Duncan. Yeah. And I wrote about this once. I think it was Herbert. Was it Herbert David? I'm not sure. Herbert David Duncan. Anyway, he was... and then, you know, this is in his first year as the president. And eventually, there he goes into Vietnam. I'm one of those people who don't believe that if Kennedy had been assassinated. I don't believe that Kennedy would have ended the war if he'd been assassinated. I think he would have tried to tough it up. But Johnson certainly thought the only way to go was to expand the war. And for all the good things he did on the civil rights and other issues, his legacy is always going to be horrific because of what he did in Vietnam.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Hey, Scott. Bye-bye. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too, sir. All right, Shaw. That is the great Seymour Hersh, the author of Me Life 4, a report on the massacre and its aftermath and cover-up, the Army's secret investigation of the massacre at My Lai 4, and, of course, many other books, including Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. The new piece is at thenewyorker.com. It's called The Scene of the Crime. All right, y'all, that was it. The Seymour Hersh interview, it'll be up later at scotthorton.org if you didn't get a chance to hear the whole thing. His article on returning to My Lai is the spotlight today on antiwar.com if you want to check that out. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll be talking again with our friend Kelly Vlahos from the American Conservative Magazine about this great new report she has about the Afghan War. Of course, we're staying. And why? Well, so that we can back some of the worst war criminals in that pseudo country so that they can continue murdering civilians and stealing and raping and doing whatever they like. Which, you know, I know. That's been the mission all along, Scott. What's the big surprise? Well, I don't know. Just that she wrote a great article about it? No, that's not a surprise either. She wrote a lot of great articles about it. There is no surprise. It's just that it's new. Okay? Okay, good. All right, so now I have just a few minutes to cover a whole bunch of news for you. Let's see, the LA Times is reporting that they're close to a nuclear deal with the Iranians. And I sure do hope that they can pull that off, man, because it's just a fake controversy, see? It's a manufactured crisis, like the name of Gareth Porter's book on the subject. No matter what you've been told, it's just a perfectly harmless, safeguarded, IAEA-inspected and verified civilian nuclear program. It's only that the Israelis and their fifth column in the United States of America like to pretend that it's some kind of nuclear weapons threat in order to push for their agenda for regime change. Well, Obama and Kerry apparently have decided they're, you know, I don't know. Obama says he gives it a 50-50 chance or something. I think they really are determined to try to get this deal done and put this fake issue to bed. Now, whether that'll lead to any better peace and a real end to the Cold War with Iran, I guess I don't know. My fear is that it'll lead directly to a military alliance, as we already see happening with Barack Obama stepping right into George W. Bush's shoes and fighting a war for Iran in Iraq. And that is absolutely horrible because Iran's sock puppet militias in Iraq are just as bad as the Islamic State, only on the other side of the fight. But they don't like nothing more than torturing innocent civilians to death for fun. The Bada Brigade and Asaib al-Haq and whatever break-offs of the Mahdi army that are no longer under Muqtada al-Sadr's control or who knows what over there. And the whole effort is really being run by the leader of the Iranian Quds Force, Qasem Soleimani. And it is absolutely wrong for America to be cooperating with Iran in Iraq. But it is absolutely right for them to make this nuclear deal. So let's hope we can get the one and not the other there. Guess we'll have to wait and see. But, yeah, here it is at antiwar.com. Jason Ditz and Margaret Griffiths, both U.S. providing air support for joint Iran-Iraq offensive into Crete. Oh, and by the way, speaking of the ISIS war, get this. Remember Austin Tice, the McClatchy reporter who was arrested, kidnapped years ago now, what, back in 2012 or something, maybe 2013, he apparently, I have it on good information, he's been held by the Syrian government, not al-Nusra or ISIS, and they're negotiating now. According to McClatchy today, French newspaper says U.S. and Syria are in talks to see if they can get Austin Tice freed. So let's cross our fingers and hope that one comes true. And then, there's all kind of more stuff about al-Nusra to talk about here. You know, Israel's al-Qaeda friends in Syria, but it'll have to wait. Back in just a sec. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest today is the great Kelly B. Vlahos from the American Conservative Magazine. Welcome back to the show, Kelly. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Scott.
Great, great. Happy to talk to you again and always enjoy reading your work here. This one is called America's Warlords in Afghanistan, about the second war David Petraeus lost. The second war that David Petraeus extended and then lost. I guess his big strategy was, hey, we'll stand down when they stand up. And so what he did was he stood up a bunch of war criminals. Is that right?
Yeah, that's about the size of it. I mean, part of his strategy was, you know, and he had gotten this in his... within his own research and within his own writing about Vietnam, he felt, and probably to a fault, that, you know, by standing up local militias in Vietnam and working with local police in Vietnam would have helped to win the counterinsurgency there, which we know that didn't work for a whole host of reasons. Mm. Well, he carried that over to his counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan. So while we were putting billions of dollars into the national police and the national army, he was standing up local police community, quote unquote, community watches in these districts.
Concerned local citizens, in other words.
Right. Now, in practical terms, the local elders were supposed to nominate, you know, the commanders or the police chiefs of these Afghan local police, which is the official name for them. But what happened was, since they were under the auspices of U.S. Special Forces, many times the Special Forces, the U.S. military on the ground, would pressure the local leaders to select certain members that they felt were friendly to their interests on the ground over sometimes the objections of the locals there. So what happened was that local commanders came from a relationship that they already had with Special Forces because they were fighting the Taliban. And so the military felt that they that somehow that would translate into them being good police officers from there on in for these districts. Well, it turned out that these local commanders were warlords, strongmen, former Mujahideen, who had already had their own agenda going on. So what happened is that a lot of these guys became stronger, wealthier, and ended up terrorizing to this day local communities, in which they have taken the power and the authority that the U.S. under Karzai was able to bestow on them and has made it a very profitable enterprise at the detriment of the people. And so they have, in essence, extended and exacerbated an already corrupt society in Afghanistan, not only corrupt but volatile. Because while you have the terror of the Taliban, you have the terror of the warlords going back to pre-Taliban days. So nothing much has changed, except that we helped to make it happen. And that's what I was writing about.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it sounds like we're also, with this strategy, it helps in the destabilization. It separates all the different anti-Taliban factions from each other as well.
Right.
And hinders their ability to resist the return of the Taliban.
Right. I mean, and like I said, a lot of these guys were integral in getting the Taliban out of their communities. But that didn't mean that they were good guys.
Right.
And it didn't mean that they had the interests of the community at heart. It really meant that they wanted to seize power for themselves. And, I go into great detail about how they're terrorizing these poor people. I mean, everything from property theft to raping women, raping boys, killing, people that they see as potential rivals, or even people that they suspect of being potential rivals who might just be a guy farming his land, burning down houses, abducting people. I mean, it's like dark ages. And, the sad thing is that our taxpayer dollars helped to fund this mess. And from the Afghans that I talk to, that this is one of the key reasons why they can't move forward. I mean, there's many reasons why this country cannot move forward that are, that range from the corruption to the violence, but this is definitely a key, a key reason why that these communities have not been able to, to fend for themselves, to move forward economically, because they're being run by the same warlords who ran the show before the Taliban. So it's just an endless cycle.
Yeah. Well, and of course, from an economics point of view, like you mentioned there, it's impossible to save and or to even choose to try to save for future investment in advancement if you know that the local warlord is just going to take it all from you. You might as well just spend it all on tonight's dinner.
Correct. And, now that that the United States is withdrawing from that country, a lot, the money is starting to, peter out, and what they're doing is these local police constabularies are now, in order to keep funding themselves. I mean, apparently, when I got a statement from the Pentagon that that we are still funding these police officers throughout the country. I'm not sure they range more than about 20,000 at this point, but from what I understand from the Human Rights Watch report, was that they are illegally taxing the citizens, and which is happening all over Afghanistan by a whole host of bad actors. But they are illegally taxing the community. So you're right. I mean, they can make all the money. They can try, to make their way, but they end up paying, extortion money to these guys, so they can, keep arming themselves and living in, some amount of luxury while everybody else is, dirt poor.
Right. There's this Vice documentary. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It came out, I guess, about a year ago or so, called This Is What Victory Looks Like. Have you seen that?
No.
It's ugly. Boy, that's victory, I got to tell you.
Wow.
And I guess the way he explains it is that up in, more or less the north and northwest, where it's the Tajiks, the Uzbeks and the Hazaras and the remnants of the communists and the Northern Alliance and all that's basically the land of the National Army. And then down in Pashtunistan in the south, and then up, in the east, all the way up the Durand line on the Pakistan border there in Pashtunistan, that's where they have the National Police, which is a kind of different organization. But he goes to show that in either case. I mean, these guys are just, and I think especially among the Pashtun police forces, all they do is just sit around raping little boys all day. That's all they do. And they have interviews with these soldiers. There's the local sergeant, I guess, in charge has got tears in his eyes saying, this is my job, is backing these guys, protecting these guys' power.
Yeah, I was surprised, maybe I shouldn't have been, but in the Human Rights Watch report, that several of their examples of these warlords were in the North and Northwest, and they were Tajiks and Hazaras who had been installed, you know, through their relationships with the United States as these local commanders, you know. So it's not just a Pashtun issue. It is just definitely, you know, very widespread. And, you know, all that said, not all of these local police departments are evil. It's just there's enough of them to be creating a really detrimental effect on the progress of Afghanistan right now.
Yeah, they're making American cops look like peace officers, for crying out loud, which is incredible. But hold right there, Kelly. We got to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with the great Kelly B. Vlahos from the American Conservative Magazine. The article is America's Warlords in Afghanistan. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. We're talking police abuse, Afghanistan style here, with Kelly B. Vlahos from the American Conservative Magazine. The local police, not the national police force, well, I mean, them too, but the local police forces built up by Saint David Petraeus, who can do no wrong, no matter how much wrong he does or how badly he fails. He succeeded at his primary mission, Kelly, didn't he, which was adding time to the Washington clock, as he puts it. Let me fight the war longer. It doesn't matter if he wins or loses.
Right. I think what I tried to do in the piece was make the point, and I don't know if I made it strong enough, was that when he went to Congress in 2011 to promote this Afghan local police force, you know, as a key part of his counterinsurgency strategy, you know, he was out the door within a year. And, you know, you could say the same for his Sons of Iraq. You know, in Iraq at the time, you know, he had stood up this U.S. paid militia, you know, to fight the U.S.'s enemies and the Shi'i Prime Minister Maliki's enemies in Iraq. But he left there, too. And what I see as a pattern here in the story of David Petraeus is that he has a lot of great ideas that he has culled from his, from his own mythology about how Vietnam could have been won. He planted them in both Iraq and in Afghanistan and then went on with his life. And I'm not privy to, you know, who made all the decisions about where his commands were and when they ended. But all I know is that he's given a lot of credit for the surge, which we see the results of now unfolding as we speak, you know, in Iraq. And then we look to Afghanistan and see all the unfinished business there and all the crumbling of all of our efforts there. And it's hard for me to see him as anything but, you know, a guy who left unfinished business. But still, he gets a lot of all this credit for winning wars.
Yeah, he's a master of public relations is what he's a master of, not
counterinsurgency. A master of public relations.
Yeah.
You know, so he sat there in front of Congress and talked about this local police force as a quote-unquote community watch, you know, and said that it was going to be key to standing up these local communities against the Taliban. Well, they might have gotten rid of the Taliban, but what he helped to do was install the most vicious, evil people in many of these districts. And I'll say that's not every district, but in enough where Human Rights Watch has had to do multiple reports on this over the years. This isn't the first time I've written about it.
Mm-hmm. Right, of course not. In fact, well, to go back, I mean, people can just check the archives, and there's me interviewing you in 2008 and 2009, before the Afghan surge, talking about how this is never going to work because it's based on the false premise that the Iraq surge worked, which isn't true. And so, and then they come in with these promises that, you know, where's the top hat and the rabbit when they're talking about in the magic wand, when they're saying we're going to change entire societies. We're going to descend our army and Marine Corps troops on these Afghans, and we're going to give them a government in a box. And we're going to hire these technocrats who are going to come, and they're going to turn Afghanistan into a Western European Westphalian nation state by, you know, well, as in the promise, by July 2011. That was what they said they were going to do. And then when Obama was hesitant to do it, they rolled him, you know, right out in the open. Petraeus and his deputy McChrystal criticized Obama and said he wasn't doing enough and we could only win this thing if the president wasn't tying our hands. And, I mean, it's Obama's fault. I don't mean to excuse him. But they went and just completely attacked the president and demanded that they get the length on their leash to go ahead and do this surge. And then it's been nothing but a catastrophe.
Right. And what's doubly outrageous for me is that it wasn't as though that the special forces, you know, installed these commanders and then walked off the job. They continuously worked with them. And when confronted with evidence from the community that these commanders were abusing locals, you know, 9 times out of 10, according to the Human Rights Watch here, that they excused or dismissed the allegations as unprovable. So, I mean, it is not as though that they haven't been warned that many of these people have been a problem. Now, some of them have, you know, were ALP and left. You know, there was one guy that I highlighted that has an arrest warrant out for him for murder, and he's a former ALP guy. But the United States will not acknowledge that he was ever ALP. And the mysterious thing is that this guy is just operating under the noses of everybody while he has his arrest warrant for murder. So, you know, it's complicity and unaccountability and impunity, and it's got a lot of Afghans upset, and we should be upset because we're part of this. This is our problem.
Well, now, so let me ask you this. If we ever could get that withdrawal they keep promising us, and including the dollars, too, would any of these guys, do any of them have enough either grassroots power or power, you know, handed to them by Americans in terms of money and weapons in the past to hang around? Or they all basically are just puppets on America's strings who would all have to turn and run from their arrest warrants as soon as we left?
Well, it sounds like to me that they have enough power to stay right where they are. They have, you know, there's the General Razik in Kandahar, who, I mean, he still enjoys our support, but his network is so intense and is so strong that nothing happens in Kandahar without his consent. So whether we're there supporting, you know, or fueling him or not, he already has enough of a power base to exist.
Right.
And as I said earlier, that many of these commanders are just taxing and bleeding the locals dry for their own sustenance.
Yeah.
So that's a sad thing. I mean, I've never been so sad, I don't think, about the withdrawal as I am now, because it looks like the place is near implosion. And I guess from what the president said yesterday was that he's going to leave 10,000, you know, troops behind now. That's a certainty.
Right.
Because, you know, he senses, the new President Ghani senses, that this place could fall apart as soon as we leave. I don't know what 10,000 additional troops left there is going to actually do, but I think that is a powerful symbol of the failure of the war.
Yeah.
That if we cannot leave because of this.
Well, and they signed a deal back a couple of years ago to stay until 2024. So, you know, I'd be amazed if Obama or Jeb or whoever's next would get them out before then. But it seems like, really, as sad as it is to say, if it is just the American presence that's propping the current system up, the sooner we leave and the sooner it collapses in whatever mess it collapses into, the better. Because America, well, like you're talking about, we've distorted the power. We've given so much power to these guys who never could have gained it themselves. those things have to shake out. These, we got to figure out, the people of Afghanistan have got to be able to, you know, one way or the other, figure out who they're supporting and you know, how they can ever have security again. It's just like in 1996 when they said, okay, we'll take the Taliban because it's better than General Dostum, who, by the way, is America's Secretary of Defense over there right now, right?
Right, right.
So they said, look, the Taliban, they're horrible. They throw women down the well for adultery and whatever, but they don't steal. And they're not corrupt. And, you know, they're authoritarian. They're even totalitarian. But they're not corrupt. They mean what they say. And they're not here just to rape you and loot you. And so we prefer them. And that was why the Taliban was on the eve of complete defeat, complete victory. I mean, defeat of the Northern Alliance when America invaded in 2001. It wasn't because they were good guys or really anybody liked them. It was just because they were better than what they'd been putting up with in the years of warlords and civil war and rape and murder and theft that had taken place since the fall of the communists.
Yeah, you know, it's awful. One of the Afghans that I spoke to for the story, you know, said that, you know, there was never a cultural shift in all of these years post-Taliban, and that there was never, you know, the rule of law was never asserted, and that the U.S. never helped or pushed for that rule of law to be asserted. So you have a culture of impunity now over the last, you know, 14 years that has just been festering. Mm-hmm. There was never a chance or a space to give rise to real pure democracy the way that we see it, but also the rule of law. So what we're looking at is just, you know, a culture in which women are still being stoned right there on the streets of Kabul.
Yeah, and burned alive.
Yeah.
All right, I'm sorry we're out of time. We got to go, but great work as always, Kelly. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, so that's the great Kelly Vallejo. She's at the American Conservative magazine, America's Warlords in Afghanistan, theamericanconservative.com.